This is Anthony Iannarino, and you're listening to In the Arena.
Step into the arena.
Insight-based selling is all the rage right now, but it isn't easy to implement or execute well. Mike Schultz, co-author with John Doerr at Rain Selling, have just released a new book, Insight Selling, Surprising Research on What Sales Winners Do Differently, and it's really worth picking up. I asked Mike to share some of his research about what fundamentals come before insight, effective value propositions, how to help buyers deal with risk, and whether or not we still need relationships. You know, I think we do. And understanding the buyer's needs. Give this a listen, and I promise you're going to leave here with actionable ideas. Here we go with Mike Schultz in the arena. Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing, Anthony?
Wonderful. Thanks for being here again. It's been a while since we talked, and you've got a new book out, Insight Selling.
Yes, we do.
Well, I want to talk about the book, but before we do that, I guess I'll do a little bit of a setup here. I drafted a newsletter for this Sunday where I send this newsletter out to about 25,000 people, and I'm comparing insight selling to an algebra class. And I think what some sales organizations are expecting is that they can sort of bolt insight-based selling onto their sales organization. But I think for many, it's more like you miss the first two semesters of algebra, and then you show up in the third semester and you don't have any of the foundational understandings that you really need to have to be able to solve for X. And that's what it feels like to me a lot of organizations are struggling with. What do you think, before we dive into your book, what do you think the underlying foundations are for a sales organization really to be able to leap to insight selling?
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of things. One thing that's really interesting is that ever since the Harvard Business Review published articles like The End of Solution Sales and articles like Selling is not about relationships, the way that those are positioned didn't say there's more to it than solution sales. It said the end. Didn't say the end of solution sales sometimes. It said the end. So what's happening is there's a replacement mindset going on where some companies are saying what we did in the past isn't working, essentially because that's what lots of people write to make their books and their methods sound exciting, new, and different. So let's replace it with this new thing. If you look at something like an insight selling, it's not a replace. It's additive. It's accretive. So one of the things that we found in our research was that it's not the end of solution sales. In fact, that's as strong and alive as ever. But to be able to add on insight, you have to build upon a solution and relationship framework, not replace out your solution and relationship framework with something that is, you know, like you're positioning it, a little bit more advanced.
It's interesting the way that you frame that up. And I know the articles, and I know what a lot of people read and what they believe. And I'm more and more convinced that, like other developmental models, like a psychological developmental model or a cultural developmental model, we're adding on top of layers that previously exist. And when you skip the layers underneath, you're really missing a big part of it. And I think that's why so many people are struggling with this idea while they're struggling with the execution of insight-based selling, because they are seeing it as a replacement when it's not. And you do need the fundamental undergirdings to make it work. And we don't want to spend time on that because we want to leap to what's shiny and new. But I don't think we're able to drag salespeople along that continuum without putting them through the paces and understanding all the other component pieces that have to be underneath it. And your book does a good job framing up a couple things. I'm going to stick to really the first part of the book, though, to give people some idea of what's in here. and give them a little bit of a tease on the book. But your research shows that high performers are more effective, especially when it comes to value propositions. And they're doing things different in conversations. Can you share a little bit about what they do different and what salespeople need to do to improve when they're working with the idea of a value prop?
Yeah. So first of all, to your comment before, I've always believed strongly in having good undergirdings. So we agree there. Second, all right. So when it comes to value, when we looked at the research, I don't want to get too boring research on you, but we looked at the research from six different angles. A couple of them are, what do sales winners actually, just what do they do? What do they do most differently? Which things do buyers actually find to be most important or least important? What actually leads to repeat sales? So we looked at it a bunch of different ways. The only factor that showed up across all of our six research slices was that the overall value was superior from the inside seller. All right, so what does that mean? A lot of people talk about value proposition as if it's a statement. You can literally look it up. If you just Google what's a value proposition, you're going to get definitions that describe it as a brief statement describing the one or two major benefits of your company and the major thing that makes you unique. Well, you know what? That's great for a conversation when you're meeting someone for the first time, but that's not why people buy. If you look at a complex sale, 6 months after you have that initial discussion where someone says, what do? They're going to buy for a collection of reasons. And the collection of reasons is going to be a rich set of reasons, and it's going to be different from buyer to buyer. So for them, for that buyer, you want them to be able to make an impassioned argument about why it's worthwhile to purchase. We call that the value proposition, and the insight seller satisfies all of those buyer conditions. Now, the one thing that I'll add to what the insight seller does differently is that they don't just sell the value of the product and service. Ever since books like The Consultative Sale, which actually came out in 1970, it talked about positioning features of a product to the business outcome that they can achieve. So for the last 40 years, selling has been about the product or the service. Now buyers are actually seeing that products and services are similar, or they perceive them to be similar, that the difference in the sale, the thing that they actually value, are the ideas that the seller brings to the table. And that is how the insight seller truly sets themselves apart.
And you broke that down in the book, if I remember right, into a couple different processes. And the first one is sort of the internal process of conveying that value. And the second part of it is working collaboratively with the buyer to create and shape that value proposition. Is that close?
Yeah, so we call those internal and external value discoveries. A lot of people, a lot of sellers, if they just get together with their peers or that person in their own organization where they think, this person's great with ideas. Think about an existing client and ask yourself the question, what are the other ways that we could help them succeed in their business? You get 3, 4, 5 people from your organization that represent different areas of thinking, and you lay that on the table. By the time you're done with an hour, hour and a half meeting, you'll have 20 different things that you guys could do that would have a positive impact on their business. So if you go through what we call this internal value discovery process, people leave these meetings excited and wanting to contact their clients to engage discussions with them. But what they do sometimes is they're excited about all the different ways they can impact their business, which, by the way, translates directly into more things I can sell to them. I mean, in the good ways, and like if they buy it, they'll be better off for it. But we have all these more things that I can sell to them. And then they have a meeting with them and they just regurgitate all the ideas. Well, the buyer wasn't a part of the process of coming up with them, so they have no ownership of them. So what the seller has to do is step back, swallow their excitement for a bit, and position the meeting essentially as an ideas meeting to think through X, Y, or Z, because we have a couple of ideas that we were talking about that might make a difference for you, but I really don't think I'll know if they're good ideas, and I can't flesh them out without you in the room. So would you mind it if we backed up and we just started from square one, but we'll frame the meeting with a couple of things that we think are good threads to start pulling on. Then you allow the buyer and you involve the buyer in the meeting of coming up with ideas of how you might be able to make a difference for them. And if they came up with the ideas, they own the ideas. And so instead of it being on your agenda, it's on their agenda. So that's really powerful for a sale. Now, the last thing that I'll say about this is if you spend an hour and a half coming up with a bunch of ideas of how you can help them become more successful, even if you're not necessarily treading down path after path of something exactly that they can buy from you, and they leave excited about ways that they can move their own success higher, the vehicle for that was you. You had what we call interaction insight. You facilitated a discussion in a way that they left with new ideas. Even if you didn't necessarily present them to them, they left with ideas that perhaps they even came up with through your great facilitation and great conversation skills that are going to make them themselves better performers. So you bring insight not just in, you know, sharing a thought, but in creating insight through how you interact. And we actually call this interaction insight.
That's great. And I think it's the way that a salesperson creates value in that sales interaction. I mean, it moves you from a salesperson and transactional to consultative. Let me take us through a couple more questions while we've got you. I describe buyers right now as having post-recessionary traumatic stress disorder. And they're demoralized, they're petrified about spending money, and I think they're not moving away from the status quo because they trust their problems more than they trust our solutions. They know their problems. Mm-hmm. Why is, and you wrote this in the book and you've got a chart to this effect, why is the risk perceived as increasing along with the increasing rewards that come along with change? And the implication of that, I mean, when you think about a chart that goes up and as the reward gets greater, the buyer's perception is the risk gets greater, whether that's right or wrong, it's their perception. Mm-hmm. How do we help them deal with this perception of fear and the status quo? How do we help move them forward?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it doesn't matter if the recession is perceived by a particular person to be still happening or over. When you go through a prolonged period of economic challenge where a lot of people either lost their job or had to fire people or lost money because their businesses were doing poorly, and for a certain amount of time, there was no brightness in the sky, those emotional and psychological feelings, they'll continue along for years and years, even if business is good, and it manifests itself just the way that you said. They'll be more skeptical and they'll be more risk averse because there was a time, literally just several years ago, that everyone was averse to anything except holding on to cash and letting people go and cutting costs. So that will continue along. So that feeling of risk for some horizon of time is going to stick with people. Now, when you think about the horizon of time, my grandfather grew up in the Great Depression. When I was in college 20 or so years ago, I would call him and he would hang right up and say, "I'll call you right back," because he didn't want me paying for the call. And then we would talk really quickly and I could hear the nickels dropping in his head because calls were expensive. Even though I told him, you know, there's no toll calls anymore. We can just talk and talk and it doesn't cost me anything. So that time horizon of the feeling that continues after an economic calamity, it can be a pretty long time horizon. Now, what the sellers need to do is they need to get the buyers to believe in four things. Oftentimes, they used to just pitch the product, that the product will work and perform as described. Okay, I'll buy the computer, it won't break. I'll pick up the phone, the dial tone will be there. But there are three other things that they have to get people to buy, and if they can satisfy them, they'll minimize the risk. One, they have to get them to believe not just in the product, but in the company, that you're a good company with which to align. A lot of entrepreneurs can tell you that this is an endemic challenge to them selling, because no matter what they're selling, no matter how exciting it is, buyers will say, are they even going to be here in 6 months? So you have to get them to believe that you are the right company to align with. You have to get them to believe that the eventual result is going to happen. So I know a lot of companies that sell training. One company I know sells leadership training. They're not selling that the leadership training will go well by itself. Your leaders will come in for 2 days and they'll leave and say, this was great training. That would be that the product performed as described. But that it gets the eventual outcome is that the leaders, a year to 2 years later, are more innovative. They're more forward thinking. They're better managers. They make their teams more competitive. That's the outcome you want from the training. So that's three things. There's the product, there's the company, and there's the outcome. But the fourth thing is they have to believe in you. People trust people. And if you can establish your competence, if you can establish your importance by creating and sharing ideas, and you can establish your integrity, that you are a quote-unquote person to trust. They don't just trust that you can give them the right advice, which would be competence. They trust that you're a good person to work with. All of these collectively will reduce the perception of risk, and they are all things that the seller can influence. It's 100% themselves on whether they themselves can be competent and trustworthy. They can position the product right. They can show that the client will get the results. If they have a client and it's a big deal and the client's hedging, they can offer to fly them out to another client and watch their work in operation. So there's all sorts of things the seller can do that's immediately in their power to reduce that perception of risk. And right now, that perception of risk is high for buyers. And I would predict that in general, it's going to remain high for a while. So sellers have always been told, sell the ROI, sell the business value, sell the return. But they haven't had it hammered on them to say, make sure the buyer believes you and go through that process so the buyer's really confident that this is a good thing to do. And when they do, at least from our research and as well from our observations, they're winning more sales.
It's interesting because I have an even, I guess, a greater experience than that without the research. And that is too many salespeople don't deal with the risk or the fears at all. And they think by bringing them up, they put the deal at risk. And the experience is by not bringing them up, they put their deals at risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think we interviewed CEOs and leaders at public companies and other senior leaders. And we interviewed this one doctor for the book. He's actually my son's cardiologist. And he's not your everyday cardiologist that does a bypass on old guys like us. He's a cardiologist that is presenting oftentimes possible treatment paths for families of children that have congenital heart defects. A surgery that was described in the last 10 years by the New York Times as science fiction at Boston Children's Hospital. They're literally selling heart surgery before the baby is born. And so it struck me, and we've established a relationship since he's my son's cardiologist, and my son has had this procedure twice before he was born, that he's essentially selling ideas. And he has to convince someone to make a decision about doing something life-altering, and they have to make that decision in hours or days, and he does this every week. And one of the things that – so we ended up talking about this book because I asked him, how do the families make decisions, and how do you lead the conversation? And one of the first things, and one of the most prominent things he talked about is that I don't just sell the outcome. And he didn't use the word sell. He's a doctor. He said, I don't just talk about the outcomes. I make sure that they know the risks and they know the challenges and they know the percents of times that things don't work. Because if we do this, we're going to have to work together for a long time. And I want to make sure that they're clear on the risks. I also want to make sure that they make the right decision for themselves and for their families with all of the facts. So we even, he said in the book, sometimes we overemphasize all of the risks because we want to make sure that people know what the possible good and bad outcomes might be. And I think that if more business sellers did that, the trust level that they would establish would be that much higher if they were forthcoming about what problems could actually happen. And then, of course, they could help the buyers overcome those problems. But the buyers would trust them, and it would put them in better stead for repeat business. Because if they deal so honestly with the buyers and what the sellers suggest might happen, if some subset of them happen the way the seller described it, not only will they think the seller has good integrity, but they'll also think the seller's pretty smart. And before I engage something big in their area again, I'll want to talk to them. And isn't that what we all want as sellers? To be a part of those early, early conversations.
We can't just leave your son, though, and leave people here wondering. He's fine, right?
Well, I would say there's a complicated answer to that one. He's home. He's happy. He loves basketball. He's smart as a whip. He's just over 2 years old. He's had two major open heart surgeries since he's born. His next major open heart surgery is in about 10 days. And he's a pretty complicated cardiac patient. But he certainly loves to slam the basketball and he stacks up toilet paper as high as he can possibly get them. And then he goes flying at it and tackles it. He is your typical little boy with a ticker that is going to need support for the rest of his life. But he's certainly home and happy.
Mike, we got to sell a lot of books on this podcast.
Well, all of the proceeds for the book that are all the royalties we get, not a part of the proceeds, but everything that we get as authors, myself and John Doerr, who's graciously offered to do this with me, every book that we sell, that our publisher tells us we sell before May 10th, the book comes out on May 5th, every book that we sell before May 10th, we will donate 100% of what we get to the American Heart Association's fund for research for congenital heart defects.
We're going to push this hard. I appreciate you sharing that story, and you share that story in the book as well, and people can read it. It's a really, really good example of a high risk, high reward situation, and how your doctor, you know, helped you deal with the fears and the risk, which have to be unbelievable for a parent.
It was certainly unbelievable, and it continues to be unbelievable. But, you know, it's funny. In some ways, it's like an iconic decision. If you can pull some examples away from business, and we have essentially all business examples through the book, but this is something that everyone can relate to. And the parallels to making any decision about doing something new, they're very similar.
Let me move into a topic you and I both feel strongly about. And I think right now there are a lot of common mistakes being made by salespeople and sales organizations. And you alluded to it earlier about the importance of relationships. And right now, for some reason, there's this tremendous discounting of personal relationships. And I believe to people's detriment. What does your research show about the effect of relationships on the sale, and particularly the personal relationships?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so again, same kinds of things. There were articles in the Harvard Business Review that said selling is not about relationships. And there are some assessments out there that you can show up as a quote-unquote relationship builder as a sales type, and that's not good. Well, you know what? It is good. If you only do that, if you and I were just pals, hey, let's go to dinner, let me get you some pizza, let's go to the Red Sox game, let's talk about fun, let's hang out on the boat and fish on the weekend, and we didn't do anything else, of course I wouldn't buy anything if we're talking about something complex. But if you don't establish the kind of personal connection that is not about value, because you have to do the value side, but if they don't like you, what we found is that it was necessary but not sufficient. Meaning, if they didn't like you, you didn't even end up in the top two. Because what we studied, this wasn't a typical study of high performers. This was a study of actual sales and who won the big sale and who came in the closest second in the big sale. Well, what happened when we talked to the buyers is that They liked the seller that won more often than they liked the seller that came in second place. But what they told us was, by and large, they were all typically likable. The ones that weren't likable, they were dismissed 4 months ago. They were the fifth place seller or the fourth place seller. So it's not that the likable seller won, although it was a factor. It was that the unlikable seller lost. So if you dismiss the personal relationship part, it is likely that you will get dismissed from the buying part. It won't get you the win, but it can certainly get you the loss.
The challenge here, though, I think, is that so many sales organizations want process, and they want to deal with it in a process way. And if you have to have people that are good with relationships and good and sort of the old-fashioned charismatic, gregarious, connector kind of way, then you limit the pool of people who have those natural abilities. What do you say to some response like that?
Well, I think that the people who are the natural connectors, it's not that they can't follow process. As a matter of fact, I think that you should put into your process, not take them out to pizza as, you know, step 2A in the process, but think of it more as like a checklist. Have I established some kind of early rapport, if it's a rapport part of the sale? When you're working with, say, a sales manager and you're going through an opportunity checklist, one of them can be, have I made some kind of connection and spent sufficient time with all of the people who will touch this purchase? Because as you know, and probably as most of our listeners know, you know, there is that either investment-focused buyer or ROI buyer. There's the one that's trying to buy the investment in return case. And there are other buyers. There are buyers that are involved with the purchase, but they're just influencers. They might use the product or service, but not actually evaluate whether or not they want to buy it. It's more just, what will my life be like if we buy it? Not all of those people can say yes, but they can all say no. And so sometimes you just need to co-opt them into being a part of saying, geez, I like them. I like the product. They treated me respectfully. Even though I'm not the decision maker here, they afforded me a certain amount of focus because they know that this is important to me, but in a different way. So literally, in a process-focused checklist, you can say, have I made the right kind and level of connection with the people that I need to connect with?
I think that's so important and overlooked, Mike. I mean, it is respectful to go and meet with them, to listen, and just to prove that you care. And that probably does as much to help generate that relationship and the trust, just the fact that you were respectful enough to ask a question.
Well, it's an old adage, but it's true. It's one of those things where it can be a cliche, but the thing about cliches is that, you know, they've just been so true that sometimes people say them and say them until they become something you don't even hear anymore. But you know, people don't care what you know until they know that you care. And you know, it might sound a little foofy, but it's true. If someone perceives they want to help me succeed, their intent is in the right place, then that's a huge kind of thing. But one of the other things that you mentioned is research. So we had our research about how liking affects the sale and how, you know, rapport and personal connections fit in. But we also looked in to say, is this just, you know, other people are saying something else right now. So what does the literature say about trust? Well, all the literature we could find was, there was this very simple point that kept showing up, and I'm talking in academic journals. It said something like, if they like you, they tend to trust you at a higher rate. Now, we know that trust is important. So if you want to get to trust, if you want to be relied upon, if you want to have access when you need access, if you want someone to take your advice, a lot of that starts with, I like them.
Let me move us to the last question here, Sab. It's going to be a little bit long of a podcast, but it's worth people spending time here talking about this last point. It's understanding the buyer's needs. And what I'm afraid of is that a lot of people have the expectation that you lead with insights. And that means that it's not completely necessary that we do the same kind of diagnosis and the same kind of deep work to do to get a real understanding of what the buyer needs. Uh-huh. What do we do when we lead with insights, and how do we make sure that we get the buyer's needs onto the table and their expectations?
Yeah, so I think the fundamental question here is has to do with who's actually driving the conversation. So imagine, so there are people out there saying that, you know, don't bother with call it diagnosis, call it even just needs discovery or understanding, doing the listening part. Let's say, yeah, you know, I run a business. I run an international business. We have an office in Geneva in Australia, and we're looking at opening more. Accounting firms want our business. We happen to really like our accountant, so we're not planning on switching. But let's say that they all retired, and I had to look for a new firm. And I reached out to 3-4 firms in the area that might be good fits. And I said, why don't you come in and talk to us? And they came in and said, okay, it's really nice to meet you. We have a couple of ideas to improve your business. So just sit back and relax. And I'm going to regale you with some things. I'm going to educate you right now about some things businesses like yours should be doing that are going to catapult your results. I would think, whoa, 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 for a minute. I asked you to come here. Aren't you supposed to say, hey, nice to meet you? So what's up? So what brings me here today? What are you trying to get done? All right, so your accountant has retired, and it sounds like you really liked him. Was there anything at all that you would say, if I could paint the picture of having the perfect relationship, that you might not have gotten from them that you would look to get from a new person? And you do discovery. But if the seller set the meeting, let's say it's my accountant and they call me, and my accountants are lovely, and they have a whole bunch of service. They're a mid-sized firm. And then they said, geez, you know, I'd like to come in and talk to you because I have a couple of ideas about some things that you guys might want to consider thinking about that we think it's possible could boost your business. And if they came in and said, so what's going on? What's up? I mean, they might do it a little bit, but if they like sat there and did a needs discovery, I would be waiting at some point by saying, what did you want to talk to me about? What do you want to share with me? What is it that I need to know here that you think is worthwhile? So it really depends on who sets the meeting. Now, the thing is that a lot of people have said over the years, more recently, oh, don't pitch. They don't want to hear your pitch. Well, you know what? If it's something they need to consider, you can't needs discovery it out of them. You have to be able to present some ideas. So if you look at it not simplistically, and that's the problem with a lot of business. The great thing about conceptual models, when it's a really good one, it simplifies reality while at the same time maintaining validity. And I see, and having spoken to you so many times, I think you see that a lot of times a lot of the positions that some consultants and writers take about what people should do, it simplifies reality, but it doesn't retain validity. Now, the tough part if you want to simplify reality but retain validity is to be exciting. Because exciting sells books. Different, crazy sells books. Well, we won't do that. Now, we happened to do this research and found that the sellers that win are selling pretty wildly differently and doing different things than the sellers that come in second place. But I'm not going to misrepresent that by saying this isn't applicable anymore and that isn't applicable anymore and only do this. You got to use your noggin and figure out which situation am I in and should I be sharing and presenting ideas or should I be doing discovery? Now, one last point on this, because I know that you said that we're nearing the end of time. If you're going to present an idea, finish, and which we call advocacy, finish with inquiry. So given what you heard, what do you think? How would you apply it? Where do you think we're crazy? Have you seen things like this before? Have they or haven't they worked? Would this make a difference? And when you're doing your inquiry, if they call you in and you might talk for 20 minutes asking questions and listening to say, you know what? I'm thinking of a couple of ideas that I even think conceptually 50,000 foot. Let me run them by you right now and let me know if it's something that we really want to dig into at another time. You might want to consider A. Now, a lot of the consultative methods have said, don't say anything like that. Say, what I'd like to do is come back in a couple of weeks and noodle over this and present back some ideas of some things, but I would you really want to think of it. Well, you know what? I think that buying's moving a little too fast for that. People want to know what you think right there. So if you're leading with advocacy, use inquiry when you're done. If you're leading with inquiry, switch it off to advocacy and share some ideas. It's not one or the other. It's about understanding where you are and understanding which one to use when.
This puts us right back where we started at the beginning, and this idea about algebra. It means you have to be flexible. You've got to be agile. You've got to know where you are. You've got to know what choices are available to you. And you've got to be able to choose from a wide range of actions and behaviors that you can take. And there isn't a prescriptive model that says this is right. This is the map is actually the terrain all the time, because there is no map that is the terrain. And your book does a really good job. First, I want to tell you, I love what I've read in the book. I'm not finished with it. I'm past the halfway point. But I think it's one of these models where the research is solid, the model is solid, and it's one of these things that says, look, you do have to be thoughtful about this too. And you do have to decide where you are and where the buyer is and what's the best way to create value for them. And you select from the range of choices that are available to you here.
And in fact, that's the idea.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Mike, and thanks for sharing your book and your personal story. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always great to talk to you, Anthony.
You can find Mike at rainsalestraining.com. Do go buy the book Insight Selling from your favorite bookseller, Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or 800 CEO Read. I'm Anthony Annarino. You can find me at thesalesblog.com. When you show up there, do sign up for the Sunday newsletter. It's my best work every week. I look forward to seeing you back here next week in the arena.